I'm Dr. Albert Buzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. Let me ask you, as a result of the last 9 months, whom do you trust right now? The answer may not be as easy as you think. Your family, friends, coworkers, your doctor, your news sources, your favorite celebrities, your legislators, everyone has informed thoughts and ideas around COVID-19 and its implications, including you. So I ask again, during the COVID-19 pandemic, whom do you trust? What's amazing about that question is that even given the sheer magnitude of people invested in what happens during the pandemic and all the sources they have available to guide them, there has been a popular answer to this question that has remained consistent since nearly the beginning of the pandemic. And he's our guest today. Dr. Anthony Fauci, the longtime and current director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, needs little introduction. He has been the voice of responses to epidemics in the United States for 4 decades. He has guided the public health measures of 6 presidents. He is possibly the most well-known infectious disease expert in modern history, and he is certainly the only one to be portrayed by Brad Pitt on Saturday Night Live. You know who he is, and you likely trust him. He's here to discuss COVID-19 with me today. So I guess I'll get right into it, if that's all right with you.
Sure, let's do it.
So many surveys of the public found them hesitant to receive the COVID vaccine when it's available. Many factors seem to be playing a role in this, but one often cited reason is the Operation Warp Speed in the development of a vaccine project very quickly compared to other projects in the past. But I've seen Dr. Francis Collins mention that the speed has been much to do about getting the mRNA vaccination platform up and running because it's been something we've worked on since SARS and MERS. And I just thought what you had to say about that platform, since most of the vaccines getting close to approval are of that same platform.
Well, okay. So first of all, I have to say that with all due respect to my colleagues, I've never liked the word warp speed. It has a connotation of almost reckless speed, and it's not. Right. And I think you kind of hinted at it, Albert, about saying that it's really the advances in platform technology that have allowed us to do things in a matter of months that usually takes literally years to do. So I'll give you an example. There are 6 or 7 platforms that are coming under the Operation Warp Speed umbrella, which means they're being facilitated, developed, and or helped out and financed by the federal government. And there are 3 separate platforms involved in that. You know, one of them is essentially genetic platform, as exemplified by mRNA. Other are vectors, such as chimp adeno, human adeno, VSV, measles, and then there's the standard recombinant proteins. So to just give you an example of why we feel that, A, the speed in no way compromises safety or even scientific integrity, but it doesn't solve the problem that you mentioned, that people perceive that we're going so fast that there may be a reluctance to want to get vaccinated. So the Chinese published the sequence of the SARS coronavirus 2 on a public database on January the 10th. I got my team together on the 11th and said, we got to partner with Moderna to develop this in an mRNA platform. By the 15th, that's 5 days, we started doing it. 65 days later, we were in a phase 1 trial. And 6 months later, we were in a phase 3 trial. That process normally would take a few years, but we didn't compromise anything. It isn't as if, you know, we injected people and weren't worried about whether or not there's an adverse event or, so now what we have is we have 3 and very soon we will have 4 candidates in phase 3 trial. One of the trials is having 30,000 people in it. Another is having 44,000 people in it. And Janssen, J&J, is going to have 60,000 people in it. So there's going to be a lot of N there to look for efficacy, but also a lot of people that are going to be observed for a considerable period of time for safety. I mean, I was just talking with the person who's running the show for J&J, Paul Stoffels, you know, telling me that there's going to be 2-year follow-up. And then we're working with the Moderna and the Pfizer people, also long-term safety follow-up. So our challenge is going to be to reach out to the public, particularly the vulnerable people who should be vaccinated, and try and get them enrolled in a clinical trial, because we really need what I call comparable representativeness of the diversity in the population. We've got to get brown and black people, we got to get Latino, African American into the trial, so that when we show that we have a safe and effective trial and a safe and effective product, that we can say to the minority communities, which are at higher risk not only of infection, but of the complications, and say, we've proven that we got a good vaccine, but we've also proven it that it works in you and not just in white people. That's the problem.
So the public perception's important as well.
Oh, it's totally critical, totally critical.
I wanted to pick up on the fact you mentioned there's multiple vaccines in the pipeline right now. And I think in the past we said 50% is the effectiveness that might be the touch point, the benchmark. But I know you said you want something 75% or greater. If there's early adoption of a, quote, safe and effective vaccine that might be 50% effective, and some of these others come along at 75 and 80, are people, the early adopters, going to say, I better go get another vaccine? Are people going to be getting vaccines that are proving to be more effective as they roll out? What's your view on that?
Yeah, it depends on what the delta of effectiveness is. I mean, if it's, you know, one is 70% effective, one is 65, I don't think that's going to make much difference. If you have the difference, as we're seeing between the first generation and second generation Zoster vaccine, which is a big, big difference in efficacy, then I think you're going to have people going to get the second vaccine also.
Right. And in the recent AstraZeneca trial where they had to halt it for a period of time, I guess they still have halted in most countries other than the UK. How do you think that's going to play with regard to some of the safety concerns in the public? And are you concerned about the transparency of this issue?
Well, I can tell you that anytime you have something like this, it really is something you see in almost every trial. There's always a serious adverse event that the data and safety monitoring boards look at. They analyze it. They alert the sites for something that is similar to or identical to that so that they don't miss a second or third event. So that's not an unusual thing to have a pause on a trial, which then continues. The trouble is, there's so much attention and suspicion and reticence in the community that even something as normal and innocent as putting a trial on hold for a while, which in another disease or another trial nobody would even think about, right now people immediately say, ah, the vaccine is unsafe. I kind of turn it around and say, this shows that the system actually works. Because when you do have a serious adverse event, the system allows you to immediately pick it up, put on a pause, examine what went on before you make a decision to proceed. So it actually gives you comfort that the system is working, as opposed to the fact that you're doing something that is inherently unsafe.
I want to switch gears a little bit. There's been a lot of media and public attention to the vaccine race. But I also know that there's the development of the monoclonal antibodies against the virus. And I believe your institute, along with Regeneron, for example, are working on that. And I think you've been quoted as saying you might bet on them as far as being an important factor with regard to bringing the pandemic under control. Can you just chat about the monoclonal antibodies being developed?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of companies that are doing that. You know, Lilly and Regeneron, and AZ is also thinking about doing that, I believe. So here's the trials that are ongoing. There are trials for monoclonal antibody as an outpatient, as an inpatient, prophylaxis in nursing homes, and prophylaxis slash treatment in families where you have an infected person and you want to prevent infection in the rest of the family. Those are four trials that are ongoing right now. The one thing that we really need to do is get a bunch more interventions for early infection to prevent people from going on to needing hospitalization. The reason I say that is that we got two good therapies for advanced disease. You got remdesivir for hospitalized patients with lung disease. The placebo-controlled trial showed it diminishes the time to recovery significantly. Then there's the dexamethasone trial from the UK, which showed that in hospitalized patients on ventilators, that it decreases 28-day mortality significantly. What we need more of are therapies that are given early on that prevent people from getting into the hospital. And that, getting back to your original question, is one of the things that we hope monoclonal antibodies will do.
Earlier this spring, there was a discussion around the serologic antibodies to COVID-19 being detected in survivors. And there was this talk of immunity passports, which were quickly debunked. But do we have a better understanding yet about what role are the serologic antibodies going to play in going forward, whether it's post-infection, post-vaccine? And is there going to be a standardized way of looking at this across the country?
You know, it's too early to make any determination because there's so many unknowns. First of all, people who get infected and recover, we find that sometimes within a period of a couple of months, they lose their antibody. Does that mean that they're not protected anymore? Or is there T cells there that protect them? There are some people who have high levels of antibody, but they're not really neutralizing antibodies that might actually not protect you. I think there are so many unknowns, we better put a pause and say, we're not going to make any definitive statements about what an antibody test means, except to say it means that you were infected. You'd like to say it means you were infected and therefore you're protected. But I don't think we can definitively say the second part of that. We could definitively say the first. Right. You got antibodies, you've been infected. But we don't know really functionally what that means.
More to come on that.
Right.
Recently, there was a flip-flop or an error in the statement of the CDC about aerosol transmission versus droplet transmission. What's your view on this and how should that message play out in the public health directives?
Yeah,
I mean, confusion.
You know, I've been so busy all day, I haven't even been able to follow that. First it was on the CDC website, then it was off, then it was on again. I don't really know what's going on. I just know that it is likely that there is some degree of aerosol transmission. I don't know to what extent it's responsible for transmissions. Maybe it accounts for 5%, 10%, 20%. I don't know. But I would be surprised if there was no aerosol in the transmission, because we know from circumstances like the very now well-known episode in a Chinese restaurant in China, in which people who were in a restaurant on the other side and never came into any contact with the person were having dinner, they got infected, which means that the circulation of the air conditioner was probably recirculating something that stayed in the air for more than 2 seconds. Because a few people got infected in that restaurant that weren't anywhere near the index case who was infected.
Switching gears a little bit again, college communities, some people are seeing them as potential or real new hotspots. And what do you feel the role is of college campuses with regard to the fact that they're younger, their morbidities are not as great as the older population, and is there going to be some localized herd immunity type process going on in that population?
Well, put herd immunity aside, I think that that's very misleading. You really got to have so many people infected in the general population, it doesn't work, because that would lead to a lot of deaths. But on the college campus, it depends. Many colleges are taking the approach of testing everybody before they actually walk into the college and go to the dorm, and then have a situation of intermittent screening to see if people are infected. And the perfect scenario would be that if a college had the capability that when a student got infected, and students will get infected, they have the capability of putting them either on a floor in a separate dorm or in a completely separate dorm where they can comfortably recover, because most of the time they're not even going to be very sick. They likely will not require medical care. If they do, obviously, get them to medical care. But leave them on campus, but segregated from the rest of the student body so they don't spread it among the student body. And above all, don't send them home, because when you send them home, they reseed the community from which they came, and it could serve, as you said, as a hotspot for a lot of spread. Leave them on campus, segregated from other people. When they recover, they go back to class. That's it.
Good advice. Back in 2017, there was a Time article about contagion preparedness. And again, this past October in 2019, Johns Hopkins had a simulation of a coronavirus pandemic. And I just was wondering how we feel we're going to be able to be better prepared the next time around. Right now, the U.S. represents 4% of the world's population, but we're triggering at just over 200,000 deaths, which represents about 22% of the deaths worldwide. So do you see us learning from this, and are we going to put things in place that will help us the next time around, because we know these pathogens will keep developing?
Well, we thought we had done that. You know, we had a pandemic preparedness plan that was actually rated by the very Johns Hopkins as the best preparedness of any country in the world. Isn't that paradoxical that we wound up having the worst impact in the world? We were the worst hit country. So something went wrong. We don't know. I'm absolutely positive it's multifactorial. It isn't just one thing. Yes, there's a lot of lessons learned. And when this is all over, which it will be, it will end, we need to look back and dissect out, do a postmortem, and figure out what could we have done differently to prevent such a degree of morbidity and mortality in our country.
I saw earlier this week that there's both an inhaled attenuated virus being reported as a vaccine, as well as an inhaled vasoactive intestinal peptide as an antiviral. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on those playing a role as far as the treatments you recommended earlier, early treatment, and also the vaccine potential modality.
Well, we've been talking about inhaled vaccines for years now, particularly related to viruses that enter through the upper respiratory tract and into the lung. So there are developers who are looking at developing an inhaled or an orally or a spray type of a vaccine similar to the flu mist that we had for influenza. They are not in advanced clinical trials, so I don't think we're going to be seeing any of that in the near future. With regard to things like peptides and interferon beta and others, those are still in early clinical trials.
I think you touched on the answer to my next question. I know it may still be a little bit early, but where do you see the future of this particular virus and this pandemic? Is it going to be seasonal? Is it going to be endemic, periodic hotspots, or is it going to fade away, hopefully like SARS did? What's your take on?
You know, I think it's so easily transmissible that I don't think it's going to disappear like SARS. Whether it becomes seasonal in the sense of returning and being around chronically is going to depend completely on the level of efficacy of the virus and how many people get vaccinated. If it's a really effective vaccine and most everybody wants to and does get vaccinated, you could probably come close to eliminating it from the country. I don't think you're going to eradicate it. If we don't have a good vaccine or people don't uniformly get vaccinated, then you might see it hang around just the same way as the common cold viruses hang around. You know, likely seasonal, not completely seasonal, but not disappearing. And that would be a real problem, because the common cold viruses generally don't kill old people, nor do they kill people with diabetes and obesity and hypertension. This virus does. So I would hate to see this virus hang around, you know, for a bunch of seasons. I'd like to see it get eliminated. And that's the reason why I say my hope is in that we get an effective vaccine and that a lot of people take that vaccine.
In closing, I want to ask a question that really only somebody like yourself has a perspective on. You've been an ambassador to public health science for 6 different presidents. How often do you think the ideology of the presidents influence federal response to different crises?
To a greater or lesser degree, probably everybody, mostly to a lesser degree, as opposed to a greater degree. You know, I just think that, forget putting the administration aside, I think that in this country, the degree of divisiveness is stunning. I mean, I've never seen anything like it. You don't need me to tell you that. I mean, when you make a public health issue and convert it into political opposition, where, you know, there should be no argument about wearing a mask or physical distancing. It becomes you're on this side or that side, you know. That is unfortunate, but that's happened. And I think that's interfered with the quality of the response in this country.
I believe we're getting close to our time. I did want to make a comment. It was nice to see that. I understand as a 5'7", you were a captain of your basketball team at one point in the past. Is that
I was hot, right? Man. I was hot.
Yeah. Very good.
Yeah,
very good.
But but I've shrunk since I've gotten older. I think I lost 3/4 of an inch from age.
Well, I just want to really thank you for taking the time. I know you talk to everybody and you give are so gracious and generous with your time, and everybody has questions for you. So I appreciate it from the American Lung Association and all our stakeholders. Thank you very much for what you do.
Right. Thank you for having me. It's a great pleasure. Thanks, Kevin, thank Albert, you. Stacey. Nice to see you.
Where do we begin to thank Dr. Fauci? Thank you to him and his team at the NIAID for continually setting precedents for science-informed measures against outbreaks, risks, and this current pandemic. Thank you to him making his invaluable time and expertise available for this episode. And one more thank you to him for tireless work during this unequaled pandemic. This concludes our 3rd episode of our monthly series. And after 3 straight episodes focused on the coronavirus pandemic, we're going to change our pace for November. Tune in next month when we honor Lung Cancer Awareness Month by sitting down with a couple of researchers who are heading up the Lung Cancer Interception Dream Team, funded by us at the American Lung Association, along with our friends from Stand Up to Cancer and the Longevity Foundation. We're going to discuss how their team is making progress on intercepting lung cancer, a public health crisis in its own right. Until then, this is Dr. Albert Rizzo reminding you, if you can't breathe, then nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.